Welcome back to Walking Away from Arcadia. This is Victor Kinzer, and I am joined by Simon Eichhornchen, my co-host. And we are lucky enough to have a guest, Josh Heath. He is the Chief Operations Officer of High Level Games and the owner of Reach Out Role-Playing Games. And he's the administrator of the Inclusive Gaming Network on Facebook and co-hosts the podcast Leveling Up. He's joining us today to help us talk about Changeling and how it overlaps with all the other games. We wanted to get someone else in on this conversation because Simon and I both definitely have corners of the world of darkness that we know better than other corners. So having a little bit more context on how you can use Changelings with all the other games, which is weird and not a lot of people do, we thought having another voice would be helpful for that. So say hello and thank you very much for joining us.
Hi. Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. Excited to talk about this. I have not run a lot of Changeling except in some LARP environments, but I definitely know a lot about the other World of Darkness stuff and creatures. So this is going to be a fun conversation, I think.
Yeah, it'll be good. Thanks for joining us, Josh.
Definitely.
The first big question is, and this is kind of the big question, even when you're not talking explicitly about crossover, is what is Changeling's place in the World of Darkness? The thing that's interesting about Changeling is you get, this swing between people who are like, oh, it's cotton candy, playground ridiculousness, it has no place in the World of Darkness, to people who say, oh my God, that's the darkest thing in the whole World of Darkness. I have actually flipped people in conversations from one to the other, even though I don't necessarily think either of those things. It's really interesting to watch how that plays out. It sort of frames a weird place on, well, what is its place in this canon? I'll punt that to you two. What do you both think about that?
I think Changeling does fit a thematically odd place in the World of Darkness, where it wants to be something, it wants to tell a different story in some ways, and then it wants to tell similar stories. I've heard Victor call Changelings, the second vampire game, and I think that's on some degree fairly accurate because they have this sort of feeding relationship with humans, but the themes are drastically different than vampire, and it's interesting. Almost all the other splats call them fairies, and never use the term changeling. It's like even some of the other games know about the other creatures within the World of Darkness, but the changelings are almost unknown in some ways, or unexplored deeply by any of the other kind of creatures, any of the other splats, whatever term you want to use for it. So, changeling just kind of fits into a different space. I don't want to say more innocent because I think that's inaccurate, but it's certainly much more about the ounce of potential hope in the World of Darkness, maybe at times. And I think that's an interesting place for it to exist, at least.
Thematically, there are a whole set of Changeling books that overlap both writers and themes from Vampire. They're not books I'm fond of, but it does have that thematic overlap with Vampire where you're dealing with older, more powerful creatures than you, having the ability to compel you to do things. And it also has that overlap in theme with Mage, where there's a sense of wonder and potential in the world. And it has that overlap with Wraith, where you're also dealing with the death of things. I'm not super clear on the overlap with Werewolf, but I'm sure there was one intended there.
I find, yeah, Werewolf and Changeling mix oddly. I don't know that there's a strong thematic overlap. I think the overlap there is mythology. Werewolf calls on a lot of myths that are kind of fairy myths. Kitsune, I'm looking at you. Nuisha, I'm looking at you. Korax, the Mokole might as well be changelings. I mean, let's just be upfront about they basically come from the dreaming. No, really, they dream their form. They're were-dragons, literally. I mean, there's a mythological overlap, there's an aesthetic overlap. Core game themes, though, ironically, not much of one.
But that said, I think there's the most written about changelings. I don't know, it may be a mix between vampire and werewolf, about changelings written as at least adjacent characters within the world. You know, maybe we'll get into that a little bit more deeply, but there's a lot of discussion about changelings interacting with werewolves, but not well, really. It's not really developed well ever.
I feel like werewolf has the most touch points, but they're always just kind of name drops, which mm-hmm. is weird. The other thing that's really interesting about changeling and its place with the world of darkness is changeling has this really weird development convention where almost all the books that have characters listed, so like the Warren Concordia, the One Kingdom book we got, really whenever you deal with a location. Some of the Immortalized books, I think, also have characters listed in the back. And most of the other games, when you get a set of NPCs that you can pull into your Chronicles if you want, they're predominantly from that game. I went back and I looked at Wraith. I looked at, you know, Vampire has a lot of city books. I don't have a lot of those books for Werewolf or Mage. But in Wraith and Vampire, you get a little bit of crossover. Atlanta had, you know, a bunch of vampires, but that was it. Didn't have any mages, didn't have any werewolves. Then you get into those books in Changeling, and they all have a meaty prodigals section. Prodigals is the term changelings use for the other denizens. You get vampires, you get mages. You don't get a lot of shifters, but you get Wraith sometimes because of that crossover with the Slua. Much less so. It's mostly vampires and mages. But just the fact that they have this call-out of prodigals, and it's almost a way they think of themselves, because they think all supernaturals are just fae. It was an interesting design decision, especially because those prodigals, unless they are Kinane, can't really interact with the fae, unless the fae are willing to keep them enchanted all the time. And a lot of these prodigals, they're not necessarily listed as Kinane. It's not part of their background. And yet they're sitting there. I've never fully understood the place that has in terms of the utility of the books.
Yeah, that's strange. That's strange, particularly. I have a lot of mage source books, and I could be wrong. I don't remember a single mage source book that has anything other than mages in it. I don't remember one. There may be, someone's probably going to yell at me afterward for saying that, but
there's a lot of mage. I'm sure there's one,
right.
But it's not
it
a norm.
Has to be, right. Right.
Probably
except
that
for
one House Hermes book that dealt with the Fae.
Right. Or Sam Haight, of course, but that's a different story.
Oh, Sam. Everyone's favorite ashtray.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, so I guess it makes sense to sort of dive in and look at the games one at a time and kind of how you can use them with Changeling. So, I guess start at the beginning with Vampire. I know, Josh, you had some books and some things that you were looking at. What do you think of when you think Vampire and Changeling?
Yeah, well, the first thing that comes to mind, there are two things that come to mind. The first are the Kiyasid, which are a bloodline which were introduced in first edition. I believe the very first book that they were introduced in was the Storyteller's Handbook to the Sabbat. And they've gone through several different presentations in the various editions of Vampire and Vampire the Dark Ages over the years. Some good, some bad, some more interesting than others. But their initial presentation was as a Sabbat bloodline of the Lysandra, which seems odd. That seems like an odd choice. But maybe before we get into that, I'll say the other kind of main thing that I was thinking about were the Ravnos, because at least in one book or another, it describes that the shimistry power of the Ravnos had the ability to be chimerical. So there was obviously, at least on some level, an intention of crossover between those two, you know, the bloodline and the clan of vampires. But there's not a whole lot of explicitly written crossover material, for Vampire at least, other than those two kind of connections that I've seen, at least.
Yeah, and I remember when the Ravnos rule that said that Chimerstry is basically real from a chimerical standpoint was released. It was in the second edition Ravnos clan book, which is, for a lot of reasons, a fraught text. But I remember reading exactly how that rule was written because I was a big fan of the Ravnos at the time. I still am certain writings of them, not all writings of them. And just thinking, this is brutal. Like any Ravnos of even modest power can just be like, oh, look, you're changeling, you're surrounded in fire, I'm done with you. And I can't imagine giving that power, that kind of power to a splat, but it's come back. It's showed up in subsequent books. I've seen it again and again. It's a really interesting relationship that they have.
But what's odd is, at least in, and I pulled out the revised era clan book to see what that clan book at least might say, particularly because they delve into the Ravnos and they connect them a little bit more to India and maybe to the Rakshasa, and that has echoes to maybe what's written in some of the Exalted work. And I was like, okay, this could be like an interesting thing. And there's a single paragraph about fairies where they say, well, what are those? We don't know what those are. And that seems so bizarre. Like you have this ability to interact with the dreaming, with the same sort of reality that the fae exists within, but you don't know what they are. Just doesn't seem congruent.
Well, and that gets into, I think, reflections of the thing that makes crossover with changeling so difficult, and that is the mists. The mists are, basically, they're delirium on steroids. They impact supernaturals, they even impact other changelings, although less so. They make it really, really difficult to engage. And one of the things that they've never explored is the mists are described as a baseline of the thing that the dreaming does to protect changelings. It hides them from the sight of the world because of echoes. And when you go back and you look at Dark Ages Fae, before the mists came in and did that protection, but at the very beginning of when reality was kind of attacking the Fae, it becomes clear why the mists are necessary. But they never deal with it beyond the baseline of relatively young entity that is part of this modern age of existence and the physical realm of this modern age of existence. Okay, that's kind of how it's been described. Well, I'm a 1,000-year-old vampire. Probably
Right.
actually fought with the Fae, dealt with the Fae, existed at the time when the War of Seasons was at its height. How have the mists impacted my memories?
Right. And
You
shouldn't
know,
their memory be more accurate than the changelings themselves about what they used to be potentially in that situation?
potentially, especially if, they are somehow related to those early changelings. Not the early Fae, but the early changelings who were Fae back then, but only kind of. They've never dealt with that. They've never dealt with do the mists impact wraiths. They've never dealt with, okay, well, if a werewolf and a Nonahi meet in the Umbra, do the mists impact the werewolf the same way? Like, those questions, even though they have all these hooks, all these relationships, there's never really been a text that talks about what do the mists do in all of these less banal contexts? And it makes navigating these things kind of complicated.
Yeah, it really does. We've done a few crossover games, and the way we've navigated that has primarily been that the non-fae supernaturals, the mists doesn't stop them from recognizing that changelings are supernatural. It just makes them think they're the same thing they are, or at least more likely to believe that, which is a little bit less completely unworkable.
I like that. I think my biggest struggle with that is it potentially removes some interesting tension about realizing that that changeling is drastically different than me. If I'm, a toreador vampire, that thing is really interesting to me. Now I actually want to seek it out and have some sort of interactions with it. Like by having the mist kind of make them think, oh, it's just another type of vampire. I worry that steals some potential story from it.
Well, and I think that gets to a conversation Simon and I have had several times, is about the fact that he tends to, keep the Fae in a bit of a walled garden, and if prodigals show up, it's discreet. I think one of the tricky things about the Mists, and I discovered this when I used the Fae in a mage game once, one of the tricky things about the Mists is that the thematic purpose of the Mists in a Changeling game is completely different from the thematic purpose of the Mists in a non-Changeling game. So to use Vampire as an example, I think you have to do a lot more of a thematic lift if you have a Vampire game and you have a Kea Seed and they have Mytheresia. And depending on the version of Mytheresia you're using, or if you hybridize them, because sometimes, that's called for, if they have that power that let them see the Fae for what they are, then the Mists end up playing a very different role than if you're using a version of Mytheresia that doesn't have that straight up power, because their ability to peer past the Mists becomes really poignant and significant, and you want the Mists to be like full force. But like in the mage game I ran, where I wanted to have some Fae because a character took Fae-blooded, but they're mages, so they are all going to peer through any kind of veil I put in front of them, and I had to deal with that. I played very fast and loose and light with the Mists. They existed. I had them forget things, but I probably reduced the Mists to like a quarter of their actual systematic impact, because otherwise I just would have had a bunch of mages that got really, really, really paranoid, because mages get paranoid when things go on that they can't make sense of because they believe they can make sense of everything. And I'm like, oh, I don't need them blowing Venice up. The Mists get complicated when you get out of a Changeling context, because they can either really like punch themes up or just get in the way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because the one time I can remember running changelings in a LARP, and I'm not even sure why I was put in charge of the changelings, but I was. We didn't even have a mist mechanic in that game because I think it would have made things too confusing for, players to kind of like work through. But it's definitely an interesting like challenge to have to work through.
Yeah, and the big part of the Mists that gets difficult to deal with prodigals, we'll use that term, is like the effect depends on the banality score of the person who's affected by the Mists. None of the other games care about that. So you end up with people having to be like, I don't have that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and that gets really weird and complicated, because you also get into things like, all right, well, we have a mage, and third level mind lets them dreamwalk. It lets them literally walk into dreams. Well, we've pulled changelings into this game, or maybe there's one random mage in a changeling game. Well, if they can dreamwalk, let's look to Oniromancy to see what that means. Oh, that means they're in a little cyst that is attached to the broader dreaming. That means they are directly observing chimerical reality, directly observing the dreaming. But you look at the rules for that sphere, they are using mind, they walk out of that generally with a full memory of what happened. It's like perfect lucid dreaming. Well, what does that mean if the Mists are an absolute supernatural thing that even the Fae can't get around? Like, what does that mean really? Questions like that, you kind of have to decide on the fly. You need a storyteller who's comfortable being like, there's two changelings in this setting. Well, their magic needs to actually work, so I'm going to assign banality ratings to everyone and keep them going in my head, but that's a big lift.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mention mage and the ability to go into dreams and dreaming, because one of the things that I pulled out of 20th Anniversary Mage was there's a really brief section about Maya, the dream zone, and in it, they basically say that mages don't remember, even with lucid dreaming, they effectively don't remember everything, so the mists do sort of still impact them. And I think that's interesting, except it does seem to both speak to itself and then counteract itself in the same couple of paragraphs. And that it's going to have to be to the storyteller's decision at that point. Like, where do I fall on this? What does it mean? What sort of information do they really retain in the long run? Which just becomes potentially more complicated than it needs to.
Well, and I think the fact that the dreaming shows up in Mage at all speaks to the fact that the line dev for Mage, Phil Bricado, did some co-development on a couple Changeling Mage crossover, just general Changeling books as well. I don't know that he did any development on the standalone Changeling games, but I do know he wrote on a couple of those books, and Isle of the Mighty is a Changeling Mage crossover text. I think they're two Changeling crossover texts. There's Isle of the Mighty, which is a crossover with Mage, and Rage Across Appalachia, which is obviously a crossover with Werewolf. And, you know, so I think he was a little deeper into Changeling than a lot of the other writers. The exception, to jump out of order a little bit, because getting into developers that did multiple lines, Rich Dansky, who's the line developer for Wraith, did a ton of Changeling writing. He actually wrote some of my favorite Changeling texts. He's responsible for both the Slua and the Red Cap Kith book, which both fill me with unrequited joy. But the Fae don't really show up in Wraith much, which is interesting because there's a lot of crossover there. There's the Keramet, there's the Slua, there are the Black Paths of Balor, you know, and Dansky wrote the Slua Kith book. So I've never totally understood that absence. I think there's a little bit in the Sandmen Guild book, because the Sandmen are the ones who, again, wraiths who walk through dreams, about how they will victimize and feed off changelings because they can siphon off their glamour and turn it into sand. But again, even then, it's kind of a side note. It's like, you can do this thing, and here's how you do it, but don't piss the Fae off. They'll eat your face. And that's kind of, they're dangerous, but you can do this thing, gung ho. And I
Yeah.
figured there'd be more there.
Particularly because there's potential historic connections between the Fae and the dead, particularly if you look into Norse and Northern European sort of concepts of the Elfar and elf mounds and things like that, which elf mounds tended to actually be old burial mounds where people so old that no one remembered who they were buried. You could potentially have some sort of interaction there if you wanted to dig that into a story about what that means and when people become so dead or so unknown dead, do their dreams, like there's a dream sort of connection there too that could potentially come up. I don't know. There's some interesting concepts that could be dug in there and stories to be told, but doesn't seem like anyone kind of dipped their hands into that pool to pull anything out for it officially.
Yeah, the Keramet are really as close as anybody got to that, and that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, it really is. I love the Keramet, but the Keramet have always kind of been, you know, a very tiny sliver of a work that wasn't really big enough for them to shine. They're one group in a relatively obscure side group of not really evil antagonists. Not really evil antagonists have a strange place in the world of darkness. And the Keramet especially are not particularly evil. They are ghosts that got trapped in the dreaming. And because they're the Black Paths of Balor, trods that lead from the dreaming into the Shadowlands, I feel like I want a Keramet book. I'm never going to get it. This is never going to be developed unless someone does it on the Storyteller's Vault whenever they open up to Changeling. But I want a whole Keramet book because the Keramet have nothing in common with the other Ad-Hin, which are the group they're technically a part of. Like, they're not fairies that didn't take sides or kind of sided with the Fomorians in the Old War. They're humans that were saturated with glamour or trapped in a freehold when they died, or whatever other hook you want to use for why they died and went to the Dreaming instead of dying and going to the lands of the dead, the Shadowlands. But that's just so profoundly different from the other Ad-Hin, and it's so ripe, and I feel like Wraith is just like brimming with Changeling crossover potential, but there's probably less crossover there than any of the other games.
The old woman smiled to herself. This was the night she would tell the story she'd been waiting to tell for almost 14 years. Once upon a time, she began. "It's a fairy story," Leela said breathlessly. "They always start out that way." The old woman gave Leela a look. "I can't tell the story if you're not gonna listen," she said. Leela straightened out in her chair and tried to look prim. A long time ago, before the white folks came to these mountains, other footsteps left their prints on the ground. Across a bridge, a land way up in Alaska, only it weren't called that then, all the way back from Siberia, or whatever it was called before history begun, a string of animals and humans and other creatures came looking for a place to settle down. Mammoths as big as a house, and bisons bigger than trailers, and mountain elk that roamed all through the countryside, and so did them that hunted them for food. The earliest ones we called the woodland tribes, but later groups came after them. But they weren't the only hunters that came across that icy bridge. Wolves came here. They did. Packs. Packs of red wolves and gray ones, too. And the people who came here first called them spirit messengers, and they believed they could cross back and forth between the worlds. And they were right. Ghosts ain't the only thing that can travel in the spirit world. A fair folk came along, too, with the other first folk. The invisible people. They lived in the hidden places where no one could go, in caves and waterfalls and the forest. And they were neither hunter nor hunted, but they were dancers and singers and helpers and harmers, and they all lived their lives just outside the sight of mortal folk. Where'd they go to? Bettina was interested in spite of herself. How come we can't see them no more? Because they're invisible, Leela said. Some folks say that when the Cherokee were sent from their lands to make room for the white folk, most of the invisible people went with them, the old woman said. And the ones that stayed took one look at what had come to the mountains in place of the tribes and hid themselves, but good. Others said that when folks stop believing in them, they just wither up and die. Did they turn into ghosts then? Leela asked. I'm not so sure they left. Someone found the jacket you lost when you was over by the creek and returned it all clean and smelling like honeysuckle. Of course, she continued, when the white folks came, they brought their own fair folk with them. My mama used to swear that she could see them dancing out in the bald by the moonlight. But then she had the second sight and knew when folks was gonna die or what day a woman would have a baby. Does that mean you got fairy blood? The question came from Josie, and the old woman blessed her silently for providing the opening she needed for the heart of the story. Your granddaddy Finagle used to say so, but then he also claimed that the blood of red wolves ran in his veins. Did it? And with House Baelor, there's a really strong connection into werewolf, because House Baelor in the umpteenth zillionth she-book we got shares their herd with the Black Spiral Dancers, and it's implied that there's a strong connection between the two groups.
And that's super interesting, because if you draw a connection between House Baelor and the Black Spiral Dancers, you kind of have to draw a connection between the fact that Baelor, mythologically, King Baelor was the king of the Fomorians. I mean, that is the... they are the most substantial modern Fomorian hook in the game. And Fomori and Wyrm, and the fact that the Fomori are possessed humans. I mean, the changeling parallels there, even though I don't always love the way the Fomori play out in Changeling, because they're really not designed for Changeling, but the mythological invocations are just unavoidable.
Yeah, and I think it's obvious that they're, just from a mythological standpoint, the naming construct, there was an intended connection there. You don't create an entire group of creatures called the Fomori in one game and just ignore the possibility of their connection to the changelings, because, wait, those things existed in the like core myths that you're drudging most of this stuff from. but there wasn't a ton of like almost intentional like meshing of that, which I think there's a lot of potential story there again that could have gotten pulled out and just wasn't super effectively done.
Yeah, and changelings don't fit into werewolf games very well, I've noticed. I've played a few changelings in werewolf games, mostly to troll werewolf players. And the only real benefit I ever found to playing a changeling was they're already possessed, so they're slightly more resilient in the face of banes, but banes are highly banal, so it doesn't help much.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of potential story with a Fianna, of course, if you kind of look into the Fianna tribe book and the connections that supposedly Bran, I want to say it was Ardri Bran of Dublin, who's like supposedly the leader of the tribe who has a fey lover, but that's only sort of like half mentioned, and these connections, these relationships between the changelings and the Fianna are mentioned and kind of discussed. I think they're probably discussed more in Rage Across Appalachia, but sadly, that is not a book that I have ever read, so I can't really
Oh,
talk too much about that.
I hate to crush your dreams. Rage
No, you
Across
don't.
Appalachia is a book that I went out and bought with just fervent joy because I was going to finally get a solid Nunahi book because it's a changeling werewolf overlap, and there's that line in the player's guide about the Nunahi and werewolves, and it was an area. The Eastern Band of Cherokee are active, and the Nunahi are even mentioned as being in the book. And yeah, it's a werewolf book where they clearly only hired werewolf writers and told the werewolf writers, write about changelings as well. Here are the source books. And the werewolf writers went, I have no idea what I'm looking at. I guess I will transcribe. I mean, the section on the Nunahi in Rage Across Appalachia is literally. The Reader's Digest abridged version of the Nunahi write-up in the Changeling Player's Guide. That's all it is.
That's such a shame.
Oh, it really is. The Kithaen get a little bit. The Kithaen actually get more space in that book than the Nunahi do, even though the Kithaen have fewer relationships with werewolves in the canon. And even the Kithaen content in that book. It doesn't really amount to anything. The Fiona Fianna connection is, I think, name dropped.
Yeah, and the
That's
Fiona
about
Fianna
it.
connection only exists like half the time, depending on who's retconning what.
Yeah,
It's so bad.
I mean, I feel like werewolf, going back to the fact that it's mythologically closer to changeling than any of the other games. Is rife with potential crossover with changeling. This topic came up recently, I think, in one of the changeling groups on Facebook. Someone was asking, "Hey, I'm running a werewolf game. There's going to be some changeling involved. What are their relationships? Give me info." And everyone kind of had a different answer. The most consistent answer, more or less, boiled down to, "No changeling in their right mind would ever have relations with the Garu. That just isn't a thing." The Pharah, on the other hand, sure, changelings would get along with Korax, Nuisha, the trickier Bastet, certainly the Mokalay. I mean, the Mokalay and changelings would kind of look at each other and be like, "Yeah, I got your number. Cool." I mean, the Kitsune should have been changelings. I mean, there's so much there. None of those connections are written for you. You have to do it all yourself.
Yeah, I guess I see what you're saying with that. I would never cross over those Pharah groups with changelings. Just in my head, from a thematic standpoint, they don't really have, can't see them finding reasons to get together, except for maybe the Nuisha. I could see that. I could see the Nuisha, maybe the Pamunkeh and a couple of the other Bastet. Okay. Like I could stretch my brain and create a story where the Nunahe and those groups interact with each other, but I don't really see it from the Korax. Like I don't really know why a Korax would care enough, except for just the general idea to like watch things and learn something new. But I don't know. I'm just not feeling it.
It's the learning thing mostly. The Koraks are obsessed with secrets, and that's what the whole eating of the eye thing is. And every single changeling is basically just a repository of secrets because they have access to a series of memories and truths about every single person they've ever interacted with that even those people don't have access to. And yeah. If you were to just leak that to a Korax a little bit, and they were to become somehow aware that that existed, even if it was twisted and they didn't understand why or what, no, I don't think you'd be able to pry them apart, actually.
Well, that and
so you've just sold me on the idea.
That and House Kaha, they're supposed to be descended from the Morrigans, who are super, super tied to the crows anyway.
Yeah, there's also a really interesting hook beyond the whole dragon dream their own form, obvious connection with the Mokalay. The thing that I find really interesting about the Mokalay, they're so rare and there are so few of them left. But the fact that they are Gaia's memory, I think there's an amazing potential hook there if, in a changeling context, if you chose to do that crossover, make the Mokalay 100% absolutely immune to the mists. Because of their nature, because of their connection to the dreaming and the fact that they literally exist to be memory, but make them fiercely and violently protective of the memories they have. But they're the only ones that have all kinds of kernels of information about Fae history that even the Fae can't pry out of the rest of reality. You've got a whole chronicle.
Yeah. I like that idea too. I think I see a lot of, like, if you're running a changeling game, using these prodigals as a way of kind of spicing up, creating some new hooks. It's the other way for me that I'm just like, if I'm running a changing breeds game, I don't know if there's enough from the changeling side for me to want to, like, scoop them up and shift them toward the story. Like, I don't know if there's enough hooks there to move them that way.
I think the trick there is the Nunahi and the Menahune. Because when you read through the Nunahi's psychology, the summer and winter relationship, and the fact that they move in the Umbra, they do not move in the dreaming, which is its own weird fraught thing. There are a lot of fans that don't like that, but it is a thing that exists, and they have totems. They engage directly and in a permanent way with the same entities that shifters gain all of their powers from. And so, you know, probably actually a very large percentage of the time, especially for the Native American tribes of Garu and the Nuisha and the other groups that are tied to North America, if they're going to a spirit to learn a gift, there's a high likelihood actually that that spirit either is or has at some point been the totem of a Nunahi. So I think there's a huge parallel there. And
yeah, I see that, and I agree with you. It just makes it more baffling than why the werewolf writers didn't include any real details on the Nunahi at all, really, in anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of up there with why the Menahune didn't come back in Blood-Dimmed Tides and why it's never been acknowledged that they would have a relationship with were-sharks. Because they would have to.
Yeah, right. That's where the myths of the, like, that they drew the Rokea from came from. It's
exactly.
Just kind of ridiculous not to have that tie there. Use that tie. You've already got these two games. Build on that. Make that deeper. Make, like, enjoy that story is a good phrase maybe that comes to mind. It's funny too because I pulled out Werewolf the Wild West thinking, you know, I bet there's at least a page or two about the Nunahe in this. It would be a perfect time for it. And there's literally two paragraphs where they just say these creatures exist, they don't like European Garu, and that's it. Thanks for coming.
I'm actually shocked they got two paragraphs.
Yeah, well.
I'm impressed. That is actually a font of word count for them.
There's one little bit I remember from maybe Secret Way, where a werewolf went looking for somebody to teach them a gift, and they found a dryad instead of a proper totem. So Changeling tried to push that connection a little bit. It didn't push very hard, though.
So was the dryad capable of teaching the gift?
The dryad gave them a blessing. It didn't give them a gift, but the dryad's kith ability is to inspire fertility in myriad forms. So that werewolf became very popular.
Which is risky in its own right.
Right. It's funny because you mentioned the totems thing, and it really got me thinking, like, this is a rich potential story where a pack goes looking for a totem, and instead of finding a totem, they find a whole group of fae that are worshiping this totem. The totem's like, "No, I don't need you. I have my protectors already. I have my people already. Why would I need a pack of wolves when I have whatever group already?" I just think, like, from a story perspective, that would be fascinating to see how Garou characters deal with it. They would probably end up slaughtering everything, but it would still be interesting to see what their thought process was before they got to that point.
Yeah, that connection is problematic. The Nunahi totems are all things that, in my experience, reading about and talking with people who are Native Americans, they're mostly just plants. Which, as far as I remember from Werewolf, is very unlike the totems werewolves care about.
Yeah, in general, the werewolf totems are definitely much more active, beings, active ideas, active concepts. It is possible, and there are occasional mentions of totems of plants and trees and things like that, but they're certainly not the types of totems that a pack would go and search out usually to be their pack totem.
Well,
Yeah,
and we golden ruled the Nunahi totems to be more interesting.
yeah, and especially given the number of Nunahi families that are tied to animals, I think there are three shapeshifters, two shapeshifters and a not exactly shapeshifter, I build an illusion around myself shapeshifter. That's a high number, and it's bizarre to me that especially those families, but other families as well, wouldn't have totems related to the sorts of things that they either turn into or create illusionary forms for themselves of. It's an odd design.
Yeah, odd, I think, is a simple kind of phrase to describe a lot of this. Like, I think what we're pulling out is there is still a lot of potential story that people could develop that's like right at the edges of having been developed, and it wasn't. It just was kind of like the dreaming, adjacent to reality, but not fully reality.
I suppose I should start at the beginning.
You, me, Becca, and Rev on the Maru. I can remember that part.
No, the real beginning. The in the beginning beginning. Once upon a time, there was matter, and energy, and love. And love meant that all the matter and all the energy were all bound very tightly together in one place.
Like before the Big Bang?
Exactly. And then something new came along. Something that wasn't love.
Hate?
Worse, boredom. Some parts of the matter and energy wanted something new, something different. They became distinct. Adversarial. In reaction, other individuals arose. Those who wanted love to continue. Two factions who fought a war in heaven.
War in heaven? Like angels and devils and stuff.
Exactly.
Which side were you on?
The tail's a dead giveaway. That's why I let them shoot it off.
A real live devil? Horns? Pitchfork?
We called ourselves... the best translation is Lightbringers. But maybe it's more accurate to use the Latin. You know any Latin?
I think I left that chip back in my quarters.
In Latin, the word for Lightbringer is Lucifer.
My best friend is the devil.
I'm your best friend? Harper, that's so sweet.
You're welcome?
So, we fought a war against love. We won. And when it was done, we blew up heaven.
The Big Bang?
The Lucifers caused everything to explode. Energy, life, excitement, the end to boredom. And, as the Lucifers blasted the universe into existence, we gathered matter and energy around ourselves, and we burned. Oh, how we burned. And we're still burning today.
Suns?
Suns. Lucifers. Devils. But love didn't die in the war. Love still existed, and love wanted to restore heaven by collapsing existence back into itself.
You're saying the spirit of the abyss is God?
No, Harper. If there's a God, it's greater than you, or me, or the abyss. It's beyond all meaning, all understanding. The abyss is just the other side of the coin. The Lucifers want energy, chaos, expansion. The Abyss wants harmony, order, singularity.
So on one side, love. On the other...
blowing things up. It's the tension between these two forces. Love on one side and blowing things up on the other that makes everything possible. Except there was a problem. In the end, we knew. Love was going to win. In the end, everything was going to collapse back down into singularity again.
And you know that because you can see the future?
No. Because it's happened before, many times. The universe explodes into existence, thrives, and then collapses back down on itself. Everything ends. Eventually, the Lucifers arise again, and everything explodes. Again. Expansion, contraction, expansion, contraction. We even created a device, a way of ensuring that the explosion would always happen. We called it the Engine of Creation. Are you following all of this?
So, it does kind of provide an interesting segue into the next game, talking about connections that were there, hanging, but not really developed. I've always thought that Mage and Changeling is kind of like the mirror of the werewolf-changeling dynamic, where mythologically werewolf and changeling have a ton in common, but thematically you have to kind of like skirt around the edges of werewolf. Mage has this really interesting relationship where mages and the fae both fundamentally weave reality into something it isn't, or wasn't before they wove it, and their relationship with each other is really bizarre because, in previous editions at least, they've framed most mages as being pretty banal. There are a few exceptions to that. Verbena, Dream Speakers, really most of the Earth traditional old world spiritual, you know, groups were less banal. But even your average, like, Euthanatoi tradition, you know, non-shamanic mage was still like 7 or 8. And technocrats, or all technomancers, were like all 9 and 10. That's, you know, that conflict, that sort of like, they're very similar things, and yet really came to a head with the errata on Book of Secrets, because the errata for Book of Secrets had, you know, 2 merits in it related to the Fae, and any technomancer, even if they're not in the technocracy, cannot take those merits because they are quote-unquote too banal. And this book landed right after the C20 PDF came out, but before the hard book and errata phase was done. And the fans all went, what is this? This doesn't line up with C20 at all. What's going on? They didn't change it. They kept it. It was not changed in the errata phase. I don't really know any Changeling C20 fans that acknowledge those like couple of sentences. But literally, mage has this relationship where mages are basically the human versions of fairies, at least as their magic is concerned. But like, where are they on the banality scale? Like, they're big, they're dynamic, they shape, they create things. They are the definition of inspiration and creativity. But they're also like telling reality what to be. I think there's a lot of like meaty exploration potential there. But outside of maybe Isle of the Mighty, I don't think it's really been explored much.
There was a teeny bit in the second edition core book for Changeling when they were discussing the prodigals and they had all their creation myths for the different splats. They were talking about mages, and I think it was the only group that they didn't like link in and be like, yeah, they're totally just stupid fairies that don't remember what they are. They, I think, pretty explicitly said that they were mortals, but that they did this whole like myth about how there was one group that was like balefire, there was another group that was like quicksand or landslide or something, and then there was another group that was like a swamp. And it was really supposed to be a metaphor for, you know, there are technocrats, they are the force of stasis, there are traditions, they are the force of dynamism, there are Nefandis, they are the force of drowning, or something like that. And I was always really disappointed with the fact that they followed that up with, and here's this helpful chart by tradition of what their banality scores are.
Yeah, that chart shouldn't exist. I mean, I look at the way mages are with far more years experience with these games than I had when I first looked at that chart. And Sons of Aether should be like maybe four banality. I mean, they are sure they work with technology, but you want to talk about the kind of wild, explosive, unleashed potential that fairies would be all about. I just In my head, somewhere, there is this amazing node freehold combo populated entirely by Society of Aether members and knockers. That exists somewhere. It has to.
That gets back to Changeling's kind of short-sightedness in regard to itself, too, because it never really gets very far into dealing with changelings considering other changelings banal. There's, you know, knockers who everybody kind of looks at and goes, I don't know about you, but I guess you're okay. But they never really get into like the real meat of that, where you would have, you know, a really, really animist, possibly rural changeling meeting a knocker from a factory somewhere and going, oh my god, you are a font of banality, go away.
Or
And without that foundation there, they can't really deal with mages at all.
even worse, and I could see this being a huge technocracy, trade over, that I think it's the Kored, the changelings that live in mines, the original knocker myth that they had to give a different name to because they'd already used the knocker name, and like their interaction with gloams or with solemnids. Like, oh, we are the changelings of mines pulling solidified solemnid out of the earth and unleashing it on the world. And, the technocracy being, wrapped up in the extraction of that primal energy to elevate the potential of humanity. Like, there is this nexus where all of these forces exist with honestly completely primordial motivations that are not necessarily good or bad in any absolute sense, that would be terrifyingly rich to inspect.
And it's a shame because the way the changeling technocracy thing is presented is changelings are on the moon. Maybe the technocracy has a station there that is being overrun by the Fae in one form or another, or they're driving people mad, or out in the deep umbra, there's a little bit of like overlap there. Or the technocracy is just so banal that it kills off any changelings that come around and try to potentially interact with them. And there is a potential there to talk about what's truly inspiring for humanity and what may, you know, induce glamour if you look at things from a little bit of a different perspective, that science is something that inspires people. Going to the moon is what supposedly causes a resurgence, right? Wait, that was caused by science and we could gather the technocracy. And if that's the case, then how can that be a banal activity?
Well, there's interesting because there are two different framings that explain that. There's the original framing, and they do acknowledge that the moon was absolutely created by the technocracy. That moment was entirely the technocracy's fault. And the Void engineers were taken to task for the resurgence. The technocracy didn't understand the resurgence. Like, they didn't know what came back, but all the meters went off the charts. Something made it past the defenses. It was big. They started seeing deviant events that they couldn't explain. And the Void engineer's leash was, like, cut down to a fourth of what it had been after the moon landing. And so there's that whole story where it was basically an accident. It was a paradox glitch in that framing. That kind of works if you're telling a very old-school technocracy story, old-school, like, from the 90s technocracy story. But then there's the C20 explanation, which is, no, none of that is true. Science isn't banal. You know, and C20 hasn't exactly explored the changelings being banal to each other thing, but it's created the framework to explore it, where everyone has their own banality triggers, and they, you know, there are a couple sentences about, yes, a knocker could absolutely, you know, create a banality trigger in a Gillydoo just by raising the thing that is glamorous to them. So the framework's there. They didn't really have the word count to dive into any one topic meaningfully in C20 because it had a little bit of everything in the kitchen sink. But I do think that change in C20 suddenly sort of, you have to look back at that technocracy story and change it dramatically. Because through that lens, I don't see what happened with the moon landing as paradox. I see what happened with the moon landing being totally the Void engineers being the Void engineers and being the one convention that's full of hope and kind of secretly skips their 101 sessions and aren't nearly as banal as the rest of the technocracy would like them to be. And I think that is a more interesting space to explore.
Yeah, and you just give me a story idea that I would love to run at some point, where you have a small cabal of Void engineers who are sent to the moon to do some investigations before the U.S. is going to land on the moon. You know, the technocracy has planned this entire thing, and they unlock the door to Arcadia intentionally. Like, you get the Void engineers there, and for whatever reason, they make the choice that we need to open this because it's going to have this sort of positive effect on the world. I think that would be a potentially fascinating story to delve into.
Well, and I think you could have different factions within the Void engineers that wanted to do that for very different reasons. I could see some of them having more manipulative, large scale, they see the big picture, you know, reasons for doing it, a little more Machiavellian. I could see a lot of Void engineers, almost in the most banal sort of way, being like, look, we can't get funding if people don't believe. What we are doing is so far beyond what the timeline will accommodate. And we are fighting with so much statistical inevitability because people don't actually think this is possible. What makes people believe the impossible is possible? And somehow they find out a little bit about the Fae. And they, like you say, intentionally open the doors. I think it's totally in their self-interest as technocrats. Their convention of technocrats, not necessarily in deference to the overall timeline, but the corner of it they're pushing, I think there's a strong case for them doing that on purpose.
Yeah, definitely. You know, whichever sort of hook you use for it, it still would create an interesting sort of, you know, story for players to interact with, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, we've talked about the technocracy. The other interesting place to talk about the intersection of Mage and Changeling is the Order of Reason. I did some overlap in a Renaissance game, and the Renaissance is like right up along the edge of the Shattering. So, are you a little pre-Shattering? Are you a little post-Shattering? Where are you? Are you the middle of the Shattering when Fae are running for the exits, but you're starting to have Changelings? And here you have the Daedalans who are fundamentally responsible for that. They did this. And the first, Fae story that I did in my Sorcerer's Crusade game, I kind of had two, and then a third appearance of the second one, was about a Dantane child before C20 came out. So, like, Banal Changeling Dantane. And the Dantane child was basically created by Kosians. Kosians doing what they thought was in the best interest of everyone, totally pursuing, a safer, more reliable existence for humanity, not mustache twirling, no nefarious, no NWO, but not understanding what they were interacting with, they completely ravaged this changeling child and turned them into a Dantane, full of resentment and everything else. And I think that's a really interesting place to explore if you want to do some interregnum wackiness, is dealing with the very early, less monolithic, less nefarious version of the technocracy. I think they end up with a very weird relationship with the Fae, but it's not a relationship they're aware they have.
Yeah. I think you could do that story in two parts too. The Kosians in the Renaissance, and then have a modern group of progenitors doing something similar. Again, same motivation. We kind of potentially, look at the progenitors as a little bit like Frankensteinian with some of their gene engineering, but they have, the good of humanity at heart in what they do. And what if they did something similar? It'd be an interesting thing to have that kind of be two chapters of a similar story, at least.
My love, when you visited London on business last year, I took the opportunity to search for this dream ring I had dreamt about. As it turns out, it does exist. It is located in Upper New York, nestled in the foothills of the Adirondack Mountains. The physical locale shows signs of former inhabitation, mysterious brick buildings gone to ruin, termite-infested hitching posts, the remains of a dusty, rutted road now choked with weeds. And a massive rotting water wheel located on its outskirts. When you come upon it, it does not look like much, but spend a night there, and you'll learn it is more than it appears. At midnight, the place becomes a spirit's Woodstock. If you look hard, you can spy the faint shimmering outlines of ghostly cabins and tents just beyond the water wheel, and flickering wraiths moving between them. Ghosts dressed in tattered velvet robes and stage actors' garb emerge from the ruins of the brick buildings and from behind trees and under rocks to form a large circle in what must once have been the town square. The night I stayed, instead of flying about and trying to terrify me, these wraiths performed a play before me. It was no ordinary play. It drew me into a strange, dark land where the moon was gray and the stars wept rain across barren fields. Strange moans, weeping, and a pitiful keening that infused me with a deep, longing sadness arose, all as if from a great distance. The keening grew into a beautiful, eerie song, and all the wraiths gathered together to perform an intricate, flowing dance, molding their bodies into otherworldly shapes and graceful figures. As the dance ended, I discovered that they had entwined themselves about me like snakes. I awoke in a panic in the middle of a clearing about 60 yards from my tent, surrounded by a circle of tin cups filled with water and flickering candles thrust into the dirt. To this day, I have no explanation for how this occurred, but one thing is certain. The Dream Ring exists, and ghosts dwell there.
Circling back to Wraith a little bit more, there are connections in the Dreaming that lead into the Shadowlands, the Black Paths of Baelor being the obvious ones. But there's also that tie-in with the Nunahi having access to the Umbra, which anybody who has listened to us talk probably already knows how we feel about, but as probably an unintended side effect of giving them the Umbra rather than the Dreaming, they also have very direct access to the underworld. And what was done with that?
I mean, kind of the same thing that was done with the rest of the Nunahi. It's giving the Nunahi access to the underworld is messy and really, I'm just going to say it, it's problematic because you've just given them access to probably the second worst corner of the Shadowlands. Like, the only thing more horrific than the lands of the dead that are connected with Native American culture is the Shoah. Like, there's the Dark Kingdom of Wires, and that is the only thing that is worse, because in Wraith, they just went straight up genocide. They just, like, quadrupled down on the genocide story. It's, in fact, a major core canon moment for the entire underworld, because it prompted one of the Great Maelstroms. The story for the Mesoamerican Dark Kingdom, I had a hard time reading it, because there's a lot of framing in it that I just went, oh, okay. And the North American Dark Kingdoms are name-dropped, not developed, sort of implied they're in basically the same post-genocide situation. Oh, and we're going to give the Nunahi access to the underworld. What is anyone supposed to do with that?
Yeah, it doesn't offer any sort of story hooks. It certainly doesn't make me want to grab any of that and utilize it in a way that's particularly engaging for my players that would want to explore any of those themes. I struggle to do anything with that.
I took a Native American lit class ages ago when I was in university, and there was this really great short story I read that I'm completely blanking on the name of and even the author. But the whole thing was, what if the ghost dance worked? What if we managed to call up all of our ancestors and just, as a group, just push the white people back to Europe? And it was one of those things that I read and I was like, well, that was terrible. And then I put my ego aside and read it again and I was like, oh no, I totally get what this is about. And as much as I dislike the idea of the Nunahi having access to the Umbra and not the Dreaming, the thing about that I really like is that it does give them access to the Shadowlands. And then Victor told me about what the Shadowlands were for Aboriginal people. And I had to throw all of that away because it's terrible framing for telling a story.
So I kind of feel about the Native American Shadowlands the way I feel about the Native American Dreaming. And that is to say, no, I'm not going full genocide on this. Like, that's not a thing at my table. You know, right now I'm telling a story and I decided for this particular story I wanted to do a Nunahi resurgence story. And so, yes, okay, canon as it existed in the books before this first game opened, okay, we're going to say that was a thing, although not for the reasons that they frame in those books, but still it's about finally having that resurgence. And I'm okay with the Nunahi framing around the Dreaming as long as there is a resurgence, because that's basically the framing that Cathayne had during the Interregnum, minus the Umbral Access. And I can buy the Umbral Access because it makes sense that they would have contracts with their totems that might give them access to that. I don't buy the Umbral Access as something innate to what they are, but I can see them contracting themselves into that. Then you get into, like, how deep that framing is around genocide, and it's like, it's the world of darkness, and there has to be a space to critique and inspect that. My problem with it is the, nope, it was genocide, that's what it is, here's your story, go. And I'm like, no, If something like that's going to show up at my table, I want to engage with and rip it apart. And they didn't really create a space for that. I'm more than happy to completely throw out what's in the books and start over, but it kind of frustrates me when I have to do that.
Yeah, like as a storytelling tool, like with the right groups, we should be able to, come together and say, yeah, the genocide happened. Let's talk about this in our story. Let's make this a point. But it's just so hopeless in World of Darkness that I can't do anything with it.
Well, and I think the other problem you run into, and that gets to a tension between Changeling and Wraith more broadly, beyond, the Nunahi Native American Shadowlands piece, is that Wraith and Changeling are like exact opposite, diametric, far pole stories, in that Changeling is defined by things are bright, things are magical, things are hopeful, things are full of potential. And I know it's all going to die. Like, I know this is impossible to maintain. And if I deny that hardcore, I'm going to go completely insane in this freehold cut off from anything that would keep me whole, which will also make it impossible for me to avoid banality forever. And it's, you start out bright and shiny and it just like descends. Wraith is totally the opposite. I've seen a lot of fans talk about how Wraith is this hopeless game that leans on nihilistic thinking, which it does, but it also doesn't, because transcendence is possible. Transcendence is possible in a way that Golconda isn't even really possible. Like, with Vampire, Golconda is this thing, and it used to be real, and then they made Solid a villain. And suddenly the entire framing of Golconda as a real thing became, is this just unreliable narrator? Are you just lying to me? But transcendence is very real, and it's something that, is happens often enough that it's witnessed and they have a hard system around it. It is a hard, approachable, tick these boxes, you will transcend. That's how real it is in the game. And so, it's almost like Wraith and Changeling stare at each other and have a staring contest, and neither of them are willing to blink. It makes it really hard to engage. Like, the hidden, ignored hopelessness of Changeling kind of doesn't mix with the hidden, ignored hope of Wraith.
The only thing that I think could potentially be interesting to do is if you did something a little bit like Mummy: The Resurrection. And I don't know the game very well. I know it's kind of fleetingly, but it creates this idea that when one of those particular types of mummies dies, their soul goes into the underworld and they become a wraith for a period of time. It would be potentially interesting if you said that changelings did the same thing. And instead of them going into the dreaming or wherever changeling souls go before they're reborn, what if they went into the underworld? And what does that mean? And when they are wraiths, if they transcend, do they then become reborn? Is that what happens at that point for them? Or is there something else there potentially that could be drawn into? It's the only sort of story I think I could tell that maybe connects the two of them together.
Yeah, there are a few she houses that have hooks into the. Well, what about the places where the Dreaming and the Shadowlands kind of touch each other? And they're all kind of presented as super nihilistic, edging into complete and utter madness things. So that they're kind of meant to be the boogeymen changelings are afraid of, rather than something that actually might be true.
Yeah, which I think that gets into what you mentioned earlier about, there's some overlap between like vampire writers and changeling. I know some of those groups were written, at least certain versions of them were written by vampire writers. And yeah, whenever you get into the we're going to try and write a boogeyman for changeling, at least prior to C20, I don't feel like C20 so much fell victim to this, but a lot of previous attempts at it. Those boogeymen don't really feel thematically very changeling to me. I feel very much that way about the way the Dreaming has intersected the Shadowlands previously.
the Lore of the Bloodlines presentation of the Kiyosid is really interesting because it gives the possibility of a kind of a different like creation for them and their connection to the Fae, as opposed to the traditional kind of presentation where they're just various Fae that got embraced and continue having some sort of connection to the Dreaming. In Lore of the Bloodlines, they're deeper than that. Victor, I don't know if you want to dive into that while I attempt to find my copy of the book.
Yeah, so what they did with Lore of the Bloodlines, which made me really happy because it's a story I could imagine happening and it has some interesting changeling hooks, is these, I think they were Le Sombre at the time. I think they had already been embraced as Le Sombre. They may still have been Magi. They descended into the realm from which Obtenebration Shadow comes. They entered some sort of contract, magical ritual, something that transformed them. The original founders were mages and alchemists that had a relationship with the Le Sombre. And part of what made this magic possible is they sought out the Fae. What they found were Thalain. So they entered into these contracts with the Thalain. And they emerged from the pit transformed. They emerged something else. Not Le Sombre. Fae touched, but not with the weirdness of your changeling who's been embraced, because that results in Fae death. And it made sense to me, and I looked at that and I thought about, well, what are the potential hooks here? The interesting thing about the way it's been described, it surrounds the world, it's underneath, it's above, it's, you know, ambiguous, is it's not the Umbra. It's not where actual shadow comes from. It's a different spiritual shadow. It's not really referenced elsewhere. And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, it really makes sense that this is kind of the deepest unexplored part of the wild, thinking wild back to, like, exalted days. And so in my head, the Thalain were there. Well, how did the Thalain get there? It would make sense to me that the void that the Le Sombre are drawing their shadow from is maybe part of the Fomorian Dream, or maybe just the Fomorian Dream, because it would be dark, it would be terrifying, it would be wild and unformed, and maybe the Le Sombre have some contract, and they're able to pull it out from a deep enough place that it isn't filtered and altered and turned into what modern glamour is, but it's still connected to the Fomorians and the Thalain. And viewing, you know, the source of Obtenebration that way suddenly makes the Kiyosid make sense. They suddenly are thematically appropriate, and their connection to the Fae and the Le Sombre comes together through not the Tuatha and other changelings as people think of them, but through the Fomorians, which is also just way more thematic for vampire. It gives them a source that doesn't make them feel out of place in vampire, certainly in the sort of Sabbat origins they have, which were even kind of the darker corners of vampire. So I thought that was the first really compelling, brilliant write-up on that bloodline that I had ever seen. And I've always liked them, but to be fair, I mostly like them because I like changelings and I like having that hook in my vampire games. I'd love to say it's because they were brilliantly written, but if I'm going to be honest, it was mostly just because I like changeling. But this write-up I legitimately just liked on its merits.
I think the only thing that I didn't like about their more traditional write-up was that they were ridiculously banal. Like, they were the most banal. It was like they intentionally made them librarians and bookkeepers and people that just sat in their libraries and didn't go anywhere, to emphasize that they would have a horrific sort of reaction. Changelings would have a potentially horrific reaction to them. The only, like, downside to their write-up that I thought was, like, okay, that doesn't make them interesting. I think what they've done with them now in V20 and Dark Ages and all of the different kind of things that they've done with them, I think there's so much more interesting potential. There's so many cool things you can do with them. I like your idea of them being from the Abyss, and the Abyss potentially being, like, a deep part of the wild. I think that's a really interesting thematic concept to think about, because for me, I always pictured the abyss as the ultimate kind of manifestation of oblivion. But it makes me wonder if there isn't something there saying, you know, at some core, all three of these concepts are the same, and what happens at the root, that living aspect of creation within the worm or oblivion or all those different things. I think that's potentially a really intriguing story to dive into.
I really like that. I like those sorts of cosmological crossovers. I also think the banality connection you were talking about, that like reclusive, quiet librarian thing is also part of the Slua write-up. Mm-hmm. And the Kiasid have always been at least aesthetically very similar to the Slua. I don't know that they were thinking through that model as necessarily being banal. I think they were trying to invoke Slua. The other part of that is the Fomorians prior to C20, and may this plot point just like stay in Wormy Earth for all time, but prior to C20, the Fomorians were banal, which I hate. Like, it was some writer who just went, we need to make them the antithesis of everything modern changelings are. They're horrible in every way. And it's like, oh, okay, but they're dreaming. Like, they're dark, terrible dreaming, but they're dreaming. Like, take a breath. And thankfully, they've moved them away from the banality framing into the dark glamour framing, which is where I always wanted them to be anyway. But that may also have informed that in some way, that, like, dark evil dreaming is still banal, which never made sense, and I'm glad it's gone.
Yeah, no, because it doesn't make any sense. Our nightmares are just as glamorous, if negatively glamorous, as, you know, our dreams are. I think you can frame the idea that our nightmares drive people to do just as much, if not more, than our dreams do in some ways. So, yeah, I agree with you on that. Do you know much about the Magyar, though, and kind of their, like, almost middle ground presentation?
I don't. What are the Magyar?
So, I'm trying to remember exactly which book they're referenced in, but they are another group of changeling-related bloodline of vampires that are not just, like, the Kiasid are a particular subset of the Magyar. They were created in one of the 20th anniversary, or they were presented in one of the 20th anniversary books. I don't remember which one now, but they're just kind of an interesting, like, side note almost, that someone said, you know what, we don't really love the way the Kiasid were presented. We want to try something else out. And they came up with this idea. And of course now, oh, here they are. It's Maeghar, and they're in the Talmehe Ra book, the 20th, the Black Hand V20 book. And they are basically, like I said, a group of changelings that were embraced that are not just the Kiasid. They're a different kind of sort of potential way that changelings could transform if they were embraced. To create another Magyar, a sire must embrace a fey-blooded mortal. If she does not, the resulting child is always a caitiff, since he lacks the unique spark to become a Magyar.
Interesting. It doesn't surprise me that it's in the Tal Mahe Ra book. That book is kind of, let's tap every single other game for vampire. There's some mummy, there's some Dark Ages mage. I haven't read it cover to cover. I've sort of danced through it, but I'll definitely need to look that up because that sounds interesting. Again, it gets back to the embracing changelings thing, which I don't love that without some extra process, but in a Tal Mahe Ra story, that you kind of end up breaking some of the rules, and by some I mean yeah. Most. So it doesn't surprise me that's there.
Well, a fey-blooded mortal isn't necessarily a changeling.
That is very true. The Kinane are ripe for those stories.
Especially now that they have their potential forever glamour bubble thing.
Yeah, and I mean, that also gets into kind of an aspect of Changeling and the other games we haven't talked about, and that is the fact that any of the other supernaturals, aside from, I think, wraiths don't get this, can take Fey-Blooded. They can either take the full Kinane merit, or there's a lesser version, Fae Touched. I'm not entirely sure what Fae Touched means. Maybe you've just been enchanted one too many times. But Kinane is a merit that vampires can take, and werewolves can take, and mages can take. And it's, we talked about a little bit in the Mortals Kinane episode, especially with the new C20 rules, it's kind of potentially a supernatural who is a Kinane is a force to be reckoned with. There's an interpretation of that state that gets up there with like the Nephilim merit from Book of Secrets. But it also gives you a very clean cut through the mists because you can then have a vampire that can just engage as an equal with the she. That's one thing we've sort of focused on the very fey corner of vampire. There's also just a huge story to be told about we're vampires, we're ancient, we're better at politics than anyone who has ever been. And the she walking in and like, okay, I'll see your skill set. And I will raise you a similar skill set, plus you don't actually get to know we're playing the game. Thanks. I mean, that's an area I've always wanted a lot of word count on.
I think it would be fascinating, particularly when you bring in the elements of the mist potentially, like you were both mentioning earlier on, that ability to manipulate and run and do the political game and then maybe even step back and just let the mists kind of do their thing and then be like, oh, well, now we control all of this and you've forgotten who it was that stole it from you.
Well, even beyond that, there's chicanery, which is the art of manipulating the mists, and then throw on top of that sovereign, contracts, and naming. And you've essentially got like the mists plus two and a half, maybe three different versions of dominate.
Yeah, I mean, quite honestly, all of Dominate, all the way up into its elder levels, really doesn't have anything to compare with, I'm going to go ahead and invest five glamour and five willpower in a gaze roll against you. Like, yes, the amount you have to throw at that power is ludicrous. Sorry, not gaze, the renaming power, where you just can completely reshape the nature of something. At least with gaze, there's a ridiculous willpower resist, but there's nothing to compare to that high level naming combined with a high level sovereign. And the, if you don't successfully resist, I can demand you go wandering into places that you shouldn't have any right to go. I can cast you into the dreaming and demand that you wander for 1,000 years on a quest that is nigh impossible to complete. But it's just barely nigh impossible to complete, so the gaze doesn't break exactly. Dominate has nothing like that.
Yeah, not even close. There, well, maybe if you get into elder level, but not even really as powerful as that.
And then you have a vampire trying to find an autumn person who can use ruin for them, and that's where the Thelane come in.
Oh, we're giving ruin to the Thelane now? I mean, we just one-upped C20 on the horror level a whole lot.
I'd give it to the Thelane.
You're a monster. I say that. I would totally give it to the Thelane. I would have a Thelane Dantane just because I'm a terrible person.
Oh man. By the way, the Dantane were one of the most intriguing write-ups in the Shining Host or the Shining Host Players Guide. I don't remember which one it was in for LARP. So much so that I made a Dantane character for the LARP. It was a Wild West LARP. I made a Dantane NPC just because I was enamored with the write-up in that LARP book. I thought, wow, this is amazing. By the way, the write-up in there does not sound anything like the Dantane the way you guys have described them from any of the other Changeling books,
I
but
need to get this book because I have never heard anyone describe a pre-C20 Dantane in those terms. I have to see this word count.
yeah. And I don't even know if it's just my memory of it making it sound exciting, but I was like, wow, like this idea of a, and my memory of it is a changeling that has turned on their fae self so much that now they use all of their ability to interact with the dreaming as a way to just kind of destructively, cruelly rip out the potential for, like, the potential possibilities that changelings have, like things, something like that. Just, it sounded really, really intriguing to me.
Okay, I do want to hunt that down, because that's what I always wanted the Autumn person write-up to be. The Dantain didn't necessarily suffer from being neglected. They suffered from their only write-up being very early in White Wolf's history, before White Wolf really started getting their stride and figuring everything out. And then Changeling just didn't get the word count to come back to them later when sort of the standards had been raised. So Shining Host came out a fair bit after. I think Shining Host was after second edition. So I'd be curious about that just for the flavor standpoint. I might hunt those books down now.
Here's the sentence that got me excited. Whatever their reason, the Dantain tracks fairies with fanatical zeal and even employ weapons made from cold iron in their attempt to purge glamour from the world. Such hunters, if once fey, may be very difficult to tell from normal changelings, at least until the fighting starts.
It's brief, but I like it.
Sounds about right.
Yeah,
there's a little bit more here, but that's like that. Those couple sentences made me go, ooh, that's really interesting.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's new, but it's more evocative writing than the Autumn Person book had.
I couldn't do it, Harper. I couldn't create a future where that happened to you. So I tried to find another way. A way that was easier, happier, more appealing, less complicated.
You threw out the entire future for me? Becca, you haven't said what happens to Becca.
Becca, the perfect possible future was always in the hands of Becca.
Becca, I always thought Dylan...
Dylan is crucial. Dylan is the catalyst and the heart. But the final crisis point, the final decision, it all comes down to Becca and the engine of creation.
The Big Bang machine, the reset button for the universe.
Becca is obsessed with the engine because she knows it can change everything. With the engine, she could remake reality, work miracles, right wrongs. She could make her brother safe, find her mother, even bring her father back to life. So, in the perfect possible future, Becca locates the many parts of the engine. She puts them back together. She recreates the engine of creation.
And lives happily ever after?
No. Because the engine wants to be used. It becomes part of her. It literally melds with her and makes her like a god. But the more she uses that power to bring Ignatius Valentine back to life, to fix the Andromeda when the ship gets torn apart, to resurrect an entire world, the more she loses herself, and the more the engine tempts her to fix everything, to crunch the universe back down to singularity and start it all over again. War, explosion, love, and blowing things up. The entire dance.
So how's it end?
There's a terrible war. Dylan and the Commonwealth against Tyr and the Nietzscheans at first. Then you, the Consensus, Rev, and the Weyists. And you're all swept up into an even bigger war between the Magog, backed by the Abyss, and the Pyrians, backed by the Lucifers. With the help of you, Tyr, Rev, and Rami, Dylan manages to unite all the forces arrayed against him into one unified front. The Commonwealth is reborn. But now it includes the Nietzscheans, the Weyists, and the Consensus. He even forces the Vaedrans out of hiding. With his friends and his allies at his side, Dylan comes to aid the Pyrians in their fight against the Abyss. But it's not enough. The Abyss is too strong. So Dylan realizes the only way to win is to destroy the Abyss, and the only one who can do that is Becca.
So Becca takes on the Abyss?
The seven of us are reunited for one last mission. In a heroic journey against impossible odds, Dylan takes us on the Andromeda to the place in the slipstream where everything began and everything will end, the Singularity. There, while Dylan and you and Tyr and Rev and Rami and I battle against endless waves of horrifying foes, Becca confronts the Abyss. In the original plan, the plan I was supposed to make come true, Becca kills the Abyss. But I stopped believing that was the best outcome. So instead, in the perfect possible future, Becca realizes something. If she destroys the Abyss, the balance is broken. The tension between chaos and order, life and death, expansion and contraction, will end. But if she lets the Abyss win, everyone she knows and loves will die. And neither of those endings are really all that great. So instead, she does the only thing she can do. She loves. She loves you all already, like a mother and a sister and a daughter and a wife. So she expands that love, and she learns to love the conflict. She learns to love the peace. She learns to love all of creation, every part of it, good and bad, even the broken places. And then she embraces the Abyss and becomes it.
Becca becomes God?
I told you, the Abyss isn't God. What Becca becomes is love, but more than love, because Becca understands that love isn't enough. She understands that pain and conflict and struggle are part of life too. Becca becomes everything, and everything can't war with itself, so the war ends. All right, so we talked about using Changeling in crossover games, and hopefully we helped to illuminate the places where there are hooks to bring either Changelings into the other main line World of Darkness games, or to bring the other World of Darkness games into Changeling for a little spice. And we would like to thank Josh for joining us today and helping us to tackle this topic.
Happy to have been here. Really appreciate it.
And Victor and I will talk to you again with our next episode. The readings from this conversation were from The Spirit Messengers from Rage Across Appalachia by White Wolf Game Studio, Coda, a play in one act written by Robert Hewitt Wolf, Dream Ring from Guild Book Sandmen, also from White Wolf Game Studio, and Coda, a play in one act, again. The music from this episode was LSD by Mon Plaisir. Today's poorly explained banality trigger. Being trapped in a cab with a driver who wants to talk about the power of positive thinking.